everyone. Welcome back to another interview for our Sunstone Murder Among the Mormons watch party. This is the interview I think that people have been the most excited for, because we are talking to probably one of the biggest stars of the Mormon Murder Among the Mormon film, Shannon Flynn, who was up close and personal with all the characters involved in the film, including Mark Hoffman. We have Brian Buchanan with us, who, if you haven't been following Brian and I, we do the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast together, where we cover the history of Mormonism starting at the very beginning until modern day, just kind of like the same format that I did with Year of Polygamy, but less of a polygamy focus and more of the interesting history of Mormonism. So Brian, can you say hello and tell us where you're zooming in from today?
Hello, everyone. So I'm here in my basement archives with all my books surrounding me to give me hope and faith to get through this.
Well, why don't you bring us into our guest? He's an old friend of yours.
Yes, I've known Shannon now for about 12 years or so. So working at Benchmark, I get to meet just about anyone involved in Mormon studies, and eventually that included Shannon. So he's got a lot of roots down in Juab County, Nephi folks, Goshen folks, Levant folks. He's the oldest of three children. Shannon graduated from Cottonwood High here in Salt Lake. Things you should know about that experience: he was on the elections committee. He was in the Spanish Honor Society and the French Club. So a man of good taste here. And then another thing that Shannon and I share in common, we both served missions in Brazil. So that's been a fun thing we've talked about. And we've got a very focused interest on how the lifting of the temple and priesthood ban was experienced around the world, and particularly in Brazil. So that's another thing that we like to talk about. Well, Shannon, obviously you've had a long interest in Mormon history. Talk about some of the things growing up that drew you to it. What are the elements, periods, figures that interested you in Mormon history?
I came from a home where we talked about gospel subjects a lot. That's the way my dad was, especially, and my mom. But I didn't really dive deep in that as a kid. But then when I went on my mission, that really changed for me. That was the first time I ever had books that were of a church doctrine or history nature I'd ever had in my life. And back in those days, you could lug all that stuff on your mission, and I did. And so ever since then, I'm trying to rival Brian on the number of books at home. So, and I'm not one of those fluffers. I've already read all these things. They aren't just there to look good. I've actually read them all.
Shannon, what's your favorite Mormon history book? Do you have a recommendation? Can you just pick one?
Yes. No. It's like picking one of my kids. Heaven's sakes, no.
Well, good. Well, let's talk a little bit about Hoffman now and how you got to know him. So I believe he's about 3 or 4 years older than you. Is that right?
I think so.
Fairly close in age, and would have kind of shared the same cultural background growing up, fairly similar areas. His early years, a lot of his, where he got started in his deceptions was with coins. And I found it very interesting in a previous interview, you talked about how there's a very easy method to, a lot of what he did was electroplating mint marks on coins to make them a lot more valuable. One question I had for you, you talked about how if you put coins like that on a block of dry ice, that mint mark will kind of flake off. Did you figure that out, or who came up with that? I thought that was very interesting.
Oh, yeah. Well, I need to just say something right now. I'm going to say things about how things were done, who did what, who knew what where, and people are going to start to think, why does he know all this stuff? He must Good have point. Been involved. Well, I'm not a complete moron. No. Let me solve another problem, because you hear something going on right now. I have lung cancer. I was diagnosed with that about 2.5 years ago. And almost to the day now, 2 years ago, in fact, it may be to the day, 2 years ago, I had part of my lung, left lung removed, the upper lobe and part of the lower lobe. There was a medical mistake, and the nerve that controls my left vocal cord is paralyzed and will never work again. I've had surgery about a month ago to help improve it a little bit, but that's just on the right side. So when people say, what's the matter with his voice and why does it keep changing? And then, very disturbing to me, I've seen several people, some Mormons, ladies, that think that there's something wrong with me and I'm creepy and my voice shows how creepy I am, that there's something wrong with me. In the documentary, they filmed my asking about that. The second question, to let everybody know this. Unfortunately for me, Netflix cut it out. I've never made a PhD out of this. Never. But I learn things. It's the way I am. And one of the ways I know about Mark and his coin thing is he wrote a very long letter to a woman in Great Britain. And she became a fan of his in the early years of being in prison. She asked him how he did the coin forgery. And he went on at length and explained it. So I've got that letter. And of course, I've read it. So that's how I know this stuff. When you add a mint mark to a coin, it will increase the value potentially. He learned a way to do it by electroplating. People had done that with glue in the past, but it was always possible to see edge marks. Electroplating, there's none. But evidently, coin people tell me, the way to detect that is to put the coin on a block of dry ice. And the heat differential between the coin and the electroplate is just enough that that electroplate will flake off. So you take a block of dry ice, you get out all of your coins, put them on and let them go. And within 30 seconds, 60 seconds at most, you know if you got an electroplate forgery.
And obviously the coin world is so much larger that, and it's coins change hands all the time. The Mormon history world was a lot smaller, the Mormon document world. And so, you know, it was a lot easier to keep things contained. But in the coin world, those go to the four quarters of the earth and who knows where they are. So there's probably a lot of those floating around.
Well, it reduces one of the real problems that is going on here with Mark's forgeries. People ask me, do you think all of his forgeries are going to be, you know, detected or known? I say, absolutely not. And they're flabbergasted. What do you mean? How can you say that? Well, it's the coins. So how many did Mark do? 10, 100, 1,000? Who knows? And he'll never tell, because my personal opinion is he doesn't know anymore. No idea.
Shannon, why don't you back up and tell us how you got involved in Mormon studies and then talk about how you met, the first time you met Mark and what you thought about him.
Okay. The reason, the way I got going is I met my lovely wife. She lived in Rose Park, the North Stake of Rose Park. In that stake was Lynn Jacobs. And of course, I went to church with her and he was teaching gospel doctrine. And if you can imagine what gospel doctrine was as taught by Lynn Jacobs, it was an adventure. So we hit it off very quickly. And I became friends with Lynn and started up the interest in collecting and buying and all that sort of stuff. In those days, Deseret Book had a good department, used and rare. The first thing I ever bought was a pamphlet by B.H. Roberts. It was a third edition of something. I can't even remember. I love this. This is great. Go to the store. Look at the books. I remember going to Zion's Book one time and weeping in their department upstairs because I thought, I can't read all this stuff in my life. What am I going to do? I don't feel bad anymore about it. I still can't read everything. But Lynn knew Mark. And so it was from Lynn Jacobs that connection was made. very brief at first, little more till 1985. For the bulk of that year, I saw or talked to Mark every weekday, every weekday. And for the 3 months, 4 months before the bombings, sometimes twice a day, every day.
Shannon, talk a little bit more about Lynn Jacobs, because he's a very important part of this story. And I, again, with a three-part documentary, you can only tell so much, not much on him. Talk a little bit about who he was and how he plays into the Hoffman story.
Lynn Jacobs does not appear in the documentary on purpose. I was very upset about that because, of course, I knew him better than Mark and knew his involvement, how deep it was. And I had talked to Titer over and over, and so he was well aware of Lynn. And so he was removed, and I was upset about that. So Titer and I had a talk about it. And this is what it boiled down to. Titer said, there's not enough room. And he died. And so we can't interview him. We can't get him sitting down in the Masonic Temple with everybody else. And it's too bad, because if you wanted to see somebody more character, more animated than me, Lynn Jacobs, holy smokes, he would have killed me in that category. But he died. He died of AIDS in 1995.
Another thing Shannon and I got to do, a very fun project, and actually one that plays into the Hoffman story, is Lynn was a collector of foreign edition Mormon scriptures, hymnals, things like that. And a lot of people don't realize sometimes foreign language editions can be more rare, can be more valuable than their English equivalents. And so Lynn gets an interest in this and builds a remarkable collection. And as part of that, he writes a bibliography that's still a standard reference today of that. And didn't do very many copies, very hard to find. And so kind of on a lark, Shannon and I decided to reprint that. And as I recall, his collection was used as collateral.
The collection went in two parts. The most valuable portion Mark used as collateral on a loan, got Lynn to okay with that, then lost it. Lynn lost that. And the best piece in it, it was a first edition Hawaiian, which is more valuable than a first edition English. And let me slide in another little secret. I talked to Titer. I said, how many views? He said, well, I'm sworn to secrecy, but it's in the tens of millions already.
Yeah, it was number two on Netflix and still going strong. I think people are really fascinated by this. And you and your relationship with Mark. Talk to me about building a friendship with Mark.
Just think of somebody you went to high school with that you're still real close friends to. Think about somebody you met at college. Think about somebody you knew from your mission. Think about somebody that is a neighbor, that now you've been together for 3 or 4 years and you do a lot of stuff with this person. I'm friends with Brian. We're similar. We have similarities. His mission president was one of my close friends from my mission. I did a lot of work things with him. Another secret, Mark knew that he was finding too much stuff. It was going to become suspicious if it wasn't already. So he started using people in the last year because he used Lynn Jacobs to find the Salamander letter. He used me to sell the Emily Dickinson poem. I was the one who found that and sold it. And I got paid to do that. I would travel to New York with him. Mark was incredibly secretive in front of everybody. There was several, 10, 5, I don't know, some amount of times that I got in that car and he kept the dash full of papers and stuff. Sat down, him quickly reached over and grabbed 4 or 5 papers and then put them under the seat. You're not supposed to see that. He did that to everybody. The way that he could keep the chain of lies going to other people is, now we know, unbelievable. He would keep people separate. He would talk to one person at Deseret Book. He would keep one person over there, stop, then go over and tell Kurt something. Maybe straight lies to both. I don't know. But anyway, so he would keep things away from me. But not everything. So I knew some things and didn't know others.
I think that's been some of the confusion, you know, in the intervening years, is people heard different things because he did compartmentalize what he was telling people. And so I've noticed that in several of the interviews, that someone knows this version of the story and this person knows this version of the story because he was telling two different versions to two different people.
Oh, you can imagine poor Brent Ashworth, how he did that with him. I mean, some people, the stories were this much on things. Man, Brent, you can't go your arms big enough at how many things he was working and buying and selling and keeping memory of it and then remembering what he told Brent about how much he was going to pay and how much he was going to charge. And then there was people that, until after it, I never even knew of.
Interesting. And you were very close to him. And so for you to not know who he was speaks to how many things he's got going on at the same time. And especially that last year, it makes it much more understandable how everything starts to crumble, because he spread things out so much. And then it all comes tumbling down.
I was with Mark when he went to First Interstate Bank and got the check for $185,000 that I came to find out afterwards. No, I knew it beforehand. I knew that Hugh Pinnock had arranged that loan, and he was on the board of directors of First Interstate, and of course also was a 70. And he went up, came back down, had the check, and then had the loan document. And I saw where the secured, unsecured, the unsecured was checked off. But he takes that check, folds up the paper, drives off. I never knew anything more about that check. Have no clue to this day where that money went. Didn't buy McClellan. Obviously, he was buying children's books. He had one of the finest first edition collection of children books in the entire United States. Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz. Wizard of Oz, sorry. It's good she's here.
I thought maybe it was a super rare book that I hadn't heard of before. So,
what did I say?
Wizard of Wiz.
Sorry. So it sounds like he mingled a lot of truth with a lot of lies. And, you know, one of the things, you being friends with him is not an accusation. It's more a symbol that Mark conned everybody, right? I mean, there's that scene of you guys driving in the desert, you know, a la Miami Vice scene. How accurate is that in the documentary?
Driving that car, that's accurate. I was flabbergasted when I saw they had got that. And I asked him, and they said, oh, Jared went online and found one that was like that. And they bought it. Driving down a dirt road, peeling out, fishtailing, shooting the gun out the window. None of it happened.
Did you ever have good fun times? Or were you part of what we've now learned are the famous hot tub parties that Mark would hold?
Mark was a very fun person. He and his wife, they loved having people come over. They had bought a hot tub, and in the wintertime months, we got in it. The most that I can ever remember were 6 people. And there were people like Brent Metcalf And one time when it was very cold and there was snow, Brenda and I got out and rolled in the snow with, you know, just swimming suits on, and then jumped back in. And I can't remember all who did that, but we would go there, and in the summer months, we would barbecue something. We knew his kids, another couple, Scott and Tanya Ryder. I want to mention their names because Tanya Ryder is quite a historian, and everybody gets to know her, needs to get to know her. But at that time, nothing odd. There was no, hey, come over and let's play Ouija or let's light candles or nothing. We were normal people. I went to church, Elder's Quorum, once with him.
That's now something that I think a lot of people are very curious about naturally are Mark's motivations. You know, what takes him from Mormon family in Salt Lake to what happens? So a couple points I was curious if he talked about much or if you had any impressions on. First, his mission in England. And obviously the documentary shows, you know, they would go to bookstores and you know, he develops an interest, particularly in anti-Mormon books, it sounds like there. The other one, Lindsay said she'd send me cross lots if I didn't draw in polygamy somewhere here. So element that I find fascinating is his mother, Lucille, was the youngest daughter of a very late plural marriage. So even after the second manifesto, but the man who did it claimed that it was authorized by Joseph F. Smith. And the way that that's been portrayed is he kind of discovers that in college and really disturbs him. So either of those two, do you have any thoughts on those?
I ended up, though I ended up selling it, a whole raft of letters and journal notes from his mission. And he never talks about that. In fact, he's very true blue in his journal notes on his mission. It is extremely disturbing to think about this person and what is wrong with his brain. I heard him tell me one time that he had gotten hold of an anti-Mormon book when he was 14 years old, but it was one that had a representation of the endowment. But he said that he wanted to pull a trick on his parents because he wanted to tell them that he had seen an angel. But he said what I was going to do is show them some signs and tokens with handshakes. And it gas them, it blow their minds. He had to have seen an angel. Because otherwise, how could a 14-year-old do that? He told me he was completely atheistic. When you think about the coins that he was forging at that age, and better ones at 16, 17, and to think of that human being able to go to a coin show or to a store with a forgery that he forged, and deceive and cheat the man that is standing in front of him with a straight look on his face. I believe he is still that way. My belief is that Mark murdered three people, not just two. I believe he murdered his father. Because when I saw him at the prison, Bill was standing there like he had just come from a hospital, arms hanging down loose. He died in 1993, 64 years old. I'm 63. He died of a broken heart. When Mark stood up to get his sentence, Bill went with in the pew, you know, thing, and to stand there and listen to your son confessed how he has murdered two people in the most horrifying way. And as we're finding out, one of the biggest crooks in the United States of America. Your prize son, your dearest son, so smart,
Have you talked to Mark since? I mean, he's notoriously hard to get a hold of. We've seen that he's written a few people in jail. He's inscribed a few things, and Brian, you can talk about that. But he doesn't really do interviews. Have you ever had the desire to talk to him or reach out to him and ask him why and what this was about?
Well, I actually did visit him in the early 90s. I went out there probably 5 or 6 times, but that was very long ago and never since. I thought I could get in. I told Tyler, I can get in even when nobody else can. Tyler got on the visit list for Mark. He filled out the paperwork from the state and he was approved. I was too for the second time. But in both cases, because I talked to the guard and said, you know, what's happening? So you could hear him move the papers and looked up. And on Tyler, they said, here's a person on your visit list. He looked at it and said, I don't know who that is. Then mine came across and I called again and he flipped the papers, said, we asked him and he said, I don't want to talk to that person. And so Tyler wrote him and wrote him. I wrote him probably 4 times, nothing. So since that old time, his kids have visited some. Dory, never.
I don't know if we want to spend a lot of time on specific forgeries, but I did want to talk about some of the general themes of them that I think are important to understand. And as I think about his methods and how he did everything, he seems to be sort of a forger of the gaps. So he knows these places where a document should or could exist, but just doesn't. And people are want to ascribe genius to him. I don't know about that, but I you know, research. I mean, clearly he's looking into historical context. He's looking into paper manufacturing, ink composition, all these things, and thinking ahead so that when inevitably it comes to authentication, he can beat it. So talk a little bit about some of the methods he used and the things that he would do so that his forgeries wouldn't be detected.
So the salamander letter, he got lucky on that one because after that thing was discovered, part of the authentication was provenance. He said, I got it from Ellen Doubleday. That was luck. He did do business with Ellen Doubleday and did buy things. But when he was contacted and said, Mark Hoffman has this letter, he said he bought it from you in approximately this month and this week. Did he get it from you? It was a miracle because Ellen said, yes, he did. The whole thing could have gone down the toilet if he would have said, no, that's impossible. Owen said, yes. My theory is he wanted to be part of a really interesting and exciting thing. That happened several times with Mark. Lucky beyond belief. But the paper, he found the paper at the University of Utah. Special collections in a magazine. So had spores, had correct foxing, everything. And what he would do is go there with a little briefcase, and then he had a razor blade with some tape around it, so it had just a teeny little thing sticking out. So he would take that thing, open that book, and just next page, pull out 4, 3, 2 end sheets, whatever, maybe over several books. Oh, so a person that's an examiner does the tests on the paper. Is it paper from, and they couldn't say what year, but 1829 to 1834? Something. Yes, it is. Then he has lots of folded covers, so he knew how to fold it. He did that letter in one try. That was one of the reasons it took the investigators so long to trap him, because they fully believed they would go to his factory and find the salamander letter, either burned up or half of it, quarter, three quarters, laying there, nothing. He said he did that in one try. Three quarters of it is faith affirming. Things that says the church is true, says things that Martin Harris is a testimony, as a testimony, and seen all this stuff. But there's a little bit in there that's contrary. One of the reasons Gerald Tanner thought it was a forgery to begin with, because he says it's too good to be true. But what he did is lifted the info out of Mormonism Unveiled, and then, Brian could help me here, Knight, Joseph Knight, Journal, somebody.
Yeah, somebody. Either, I think it was maybe the Newell Knight history. There were some elements of that do resemble elements that Mark.
So he reads that. For all I know, he had those two books open right while he was writing so that he could not copy it, because that looks like a forgery, but just takes the sentiment and then puts it in Martin's mouth, the way Martin would sound. And why does he do that? It's really simple. If he has a letter from Brigham Young to somebody, Orson Pratt, and says, love what you do, and you're doing a great mission, you know, in Great Britain, and the Lord will help you, and keep doing this or that, and you know, we're taking care of your wife. How much would that sell for in those days? I'll make up a number. That would sell for $1,000. Same handwriting, same two subjects. Orson, I hate your guts. If I can get you excommunicated, I am going to do it. I want you to come home right now, because I am sick to death of what you're doing, and I've gotten a report that somebody, and maybe you, has been fornicating with some member. How much does that one sell for? $15,000. What's hard to figure out about that? Some people, gosh, we can't understand why he's doing this stuff that he does. Hello? He does the stuff that will pass, but boom, it's got to have a zinger. Now all this stuff did that.
Shannon, when you saw some of those, you know, jaw-dropping discoveries, as you say, how were you reacting to it at the time?
I knew it was shocking. I mean, the real stinker wasn't that one. The real stinker that I ever heard of that was the supposed part of the McClellan collection, of Emma writing to William McClellan saying that the first person to the person to pray to God was Alvin. The first person to pray afterwards and see Nephi / Moroni, but then Alvin died accidentally. So Joseph just stepped in. Wow, our church is not going to just swallow that one easy. Strangely, today, that doesn't bother me that much. That could actually be true, and I still would keep going to church.
The salamander letter is fascinating, too, because it's part of what seems to be this arc that he's got going on, leading to what seems to be creating the 116 pages, right? He's got Jeff Salt doing word analysis. He would now have a couple examples of Martin Harris's handwriting that he's created. You have the Lucy Mack letter that seems to have references to material from the 116 pages. Does that seem to you where he was leading with all of those?
I don't think he would have ever done it, because he told me in 1985 that he was getting tired of doing Mormon stuff. and he was going to just try to move to American stuff. And so the Oath of a Free Man is an example of what it turns out. We find out he'd been doing a lot of Americana forgeries, and he wanted to just step away from the Mormon stuff. So my belief is he would have never done the 116 because it's just, it became too hard. Too much scrutiny. Just move off. Now, here is what is true. He did all this stuff for money, and he would have forged anything if he needed some money. So would he have pulled off one or two Book of Lehi pages? Sure. And why? Because he's got something? No, he needs a chunk of dough.
Along those lines, too, something that you've brought up that I don't think is widely known is there were a lot of low-level ones, apparently, that he would do for ward members or somebody that were sort of personalized forgeries. Oh, your grandpa was this mission president. Oh, I just happen to have a letter from, you know, Heber J. Grant or something to your ancestor. It's $100.
He may have been doing that. I did see him buy and sell cut signatures, you know, a cut Thomas Jefferson. He would be in New York, and he would take two of those to a book dealer there. I'd be with him. He would sell them, and that was just some cash in his pocket.
Well, let's go back to the transition to Americana, because that's an important part of where things go. And, I mean, obviously, the Oath of the Freeman is huge. So talk a little bit more about that was brought up in the documentary, and people may know a little about it. Talk about why the document's important, and then what I find so interesting is how he discovers it.
That one was very elaborate, but he may have told me that what he did is he had gone to New York, and on the way back, he had a catalog from Sotheby's. He found an entry in there for a piece that was going to go on sale called New England's Jonas Washed Up on London Shore. And in it is a text of the Oath of a Free Man. And he looked at that and either knew it somehow or learned it there how important that was. There was the Oath of a Free Man, there was another one, and then the third one was a hymn book. And the first two, their existence is known of, but an actual exemplar to this day does not exist. So Mark went to back east somewhere, and he was able to see the hymnal. And of course, at the third printing, the type is the same and the paper is the same. And somehow he was allowed to actually look at, touch it, and look at it with a high magnification lupe. So he gets down and he can see the chain mark of the paper and memorizes it. So then he comes back to Utah, and he gets the paper from BYU, a Bible that is in open stacks in those days. It's unbelievable. That was printed in England the same time period. Again with the loop, finds the correct chain mark. He takes paper out of there, takes it home, and then comes up with text. Has a plate made, and then prints with a hand. You've seen them, Brian, those hand presses. Oh, show that you twist the handle, you know, on the correct paper. The paper, he finds the correct ink, then burns some of the paper and mixes that burn in the ink so that when it is eventually tested, the paper is not a forgery. It's legitimate. Paper's real. The ink's sort of real. The question is, how long has that ink been on the paper? 1 year or 150 years? Burns that, so when it goes for its cyclotron test, it says that ink indicates 1685. And again, he just doesn't copy the text out of New England's Jonas. Close. And it was a text that everybody from Library of Science looked at it and said, yeah, that seems real. The first item ever printed in the Americas. Mark should get a tattoo on his head. Hubris. Because the hubris he has is just unfathomable.
Very briefly, let's talk a little bit about how he then discovers it, because I think that is such a good example of him thinking ahead, knowing he's going to have a story for it later. Where does he find it, and how does he back it up?
This one is real smart. All the time, for whatever he forges and sells, provenance way, he has to get it out of his hands. So he goes to New York to a place called Argosy Books. And Argosy Books has a thing just like Benchmark does, though theirs is 100 times bigger, where there's a pamphlet section. And they're cheap pamphlets, so the bookstore's not going to encapsulate all of them. They just kind of stack them up, like comic books or something. So what he did was he had printed a kind of a dumb poem that's printed, and on the top of it is Oath of a Free Man. He takes it in to Argosy Books. He sticks it in the thing after he has looked at the marking on the pamphlet. Every bookstore has a little code. They'll have some letters, numbers, and then a price. And they're all unique, so they know it's theirs. Well, he figures out what theirs is. And in a pencil, because it always has to be done in pencil, you can't ruin the work by putting it in ink. So he does in pencil, puts it in, walks around for 10 minutes, goes through the stack, pulls out 1, 2, 3, Oath of a Free Man, takes it up front, goes to the cashier. So the cashier does what they do all day long. Oath of a Free Man, $25. You know, anatomy of a spleen, whatever, $10. Pays for it, has the receipt written. He gives it to Schiller Wapner. They were children book dealers. He just didn't pick them off the street. That's why he was there. What do? They call Argosy, and somebody eventually takes that receipt to Argosy Books. Is this your receipt? Yes. Who did it? Oh, it says Kimmy. Kimmy. Yeah. Did you do this? Yeah. Was there something weird about it? No, it's just four little pamphlets, broadsheet. Okay, thank you. In that moment, it is out of his hands. Because Argosy Books, let's say somebody's really investigating. Can you tell me where you bought this? Oh, are you kidding? We bought this 5 years ago. Just who knows? And they could go to that same rack and say the same thing. Sure, we bought 100 of these from somebody in Boston. Who knows?
And I think things like this, people looking back now, how did no one know? These are part of the reasons why no one knew, is because he was thinking ahead and doing things like this, knowing that people are going to check on the story later on. And so he's covering his tracks as much as he can. Like you say, obviously, there's so many moments that's just happenstance. Luck of the game, he wins. But, he's thinking about these kinds of things. And, you haven't had a major forgery in a while, really. I mean, so it's not like it's on people's minds. And, naturally, we tend to believe people when they tell us things. So, there were reasons that people, the red flags weren't going up more than they did.
Shannon, obviously, we've talked about your friendship with Mark and some of these documents, but can you tell us about your reaction and what was going through your head when the bombs were going off? Were you scared? Did you feel like you were a target? Can you talk about that time period?
That night at my house, I get a phone call from Kurt Bench, and he said, "Did you see the news?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Did you notice that somebody came in with a green and gray jacket? Doesn't that sound like Mark? I said, no. Now, the reason I said no was I didn't want that to be true. Day two, that changes things significantly because Mark is now involved. But of course, I had no clue how. Because, you know, him, a new go to the hospital, but, you know, any of the things that happened that would have made him look guilty, none of that was coming out initially. And so I went on for a long time, not believing that it was Mark. And I never thought it had anything to do with me. Kurt and I went down to see the police to give our little information about Mark. And then we drove up to where the car was blown up. And we both stood at the yellow tape and saw the car still smoking. But neither of us believed that it was Mark. Now, we did look under my car because we thought there may be bombs being placed, but with no idea. Who knows where this was coming from?
There's a clip in the documentary about, I don't know, you're being interviewed by, it seems like a news broadcaster, but there's a group of you. Brent Metcalf is there. You're there. And it sort of alludes that Brent Metcalf might have been a suspect. Were you going through a similar process? And what was that like, being that close to it and being questioned for your involvement?
Shelley Osterloh had a program, and I had not been invited to that. But I came just to be part of the audience. Of course, when she shot me, she turned and got the camera to turn to ask me. But you see, by that time, I'd already been arrested. I'd already spent time in jail. The reason I was arrested, they didn't give a crap about the gun. That was a federal charge. That was a way to put my head in a vice and squeeze it.
Can you talk about your experience and the arrest and what that was like?
I was interviewed on a Friday night, and I went from a suspect of interest to a suspect to arrest. If they could have taken out a sap and hit me with it, they would have. Like, it became so intense on their part that they got the chief of Salt Lake Police, Bud Willoughby, out of bed and stand outside the room and look at me. So I went downstairs in handcuffs, and I had done the wrong thing. I talked, because I am a Mormon. And what is the best thing for Mormons to do? What are you taught your whole life?
Confess. Tell everything.
See? Look at that. You know exactly. If you tell the truth and you're very sad and you're repentant, then what happens? Well, then they send you home. And they'll get back to you later and tell you what your punishment is. Now, I hadn't talked to an attorney till the very end. And then Ken Farnsworth calls up an attorney and she says, how long have you been there? I said, about 3 hours. How long have you been talking? The whole time. She said, okay. Number one, shut up. Do not say anything. These people are not your friend. They're going to arrest you and take you to jail. Do not talk to anybody. I eventually was put in the drunk tank, and I spent the night there on the floor. It was a room that accommodated 8 people. They had about 25 in there.
So you went through all of that. Did you feel like the Mormon studies community supported you during this time, or did you feel like everyone suspected everybody?
The people that I knew and really cared about were very supportive. Lynn Jacobs, some of the people at Sunstone back in those days. But they were supportive of everybody because Kurt Bench was supportive. So it was like, man, this is terrible for you. And Kurt was interviewed by the police at length. Lynn, of course, at length. So we all had, you know, great sympathy with going through the same things.
I know a lot of times people hear about the various books that have been written about the Hoffman case and wonder, you know, what should I read? So I wanted to get your thoughts on kind of maybe the four main ones. So Salamander, Mormon Murders, Gathering of Saints, and then Victims. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, I'll add one more. You need to put The Poet and the Murderer in that group. I didn't help any of them except Poet and the Murderer. Now, the problem with that is it's very narrow. The scope of it's very narrow. So if you want to get, if you say, I've heard about this, I don't know anything, don't do that one because it's just one section. Victims I actually helped with. That's actually pretty good in factualness, but it's a little more narrow and definitely with the direction. So not the whole story. Salamander. Of the remaining three, I would pick that one because it's very generalized. Now, they've got tons of errors in it. Me and Alan Roberts got in big fights about it. Theirs had some advantages because while it was being written, they were getting surreptitious information from the police department. The other two, the Lindsay one, I dislike that intensely. The last one, I hate. I absolutely hate. I did an interview when it first came out of a television show, and I just described errors after errors. And me and the two authors just fought about it the whole time I was on.
Well, I appreciate that. Brian, do you have any other final questions for Shannon?
Shannon, I guess I would ask, what do you think the long-term impacts on Mormon history have been from Hoffman? How did he change trajectories of things? How are things different now because of him?
Early in 1986, I went to the historical department at the church office building, and they had just installed a security station. And you could show a driver's license or a temple recommend. I didn't know what was going on, so I just showed my license. They wouldn't let me in, had me sit. About 10 minutes later, somebody from security came down and told me I had been designated persona non grata. I was no longer to go in there. I spent an hour and a half on the phone, on a payphone, right there, going back and forth between Ben Boyke Backer and Dean Larson. Dean Larson was the head of the historical department. All bucking blame, putting up the corporate wall and hiding behind it. I finally figured out that there was a wall and I couldn't get over it. I am still persona non grata. I cannot go to any secure thing that the church operates to this day. Brent Metcalf can, Sandra Tanner can, not me. There are still people in that church bureaucracy that think that I had something to do with it and getting away with it. Because years ago, somebody in the county attorney's office, police department, told them that, and they still believe it. I don't do anything more about it because I think someday they're going to come to and apologize to me. Yeah, right. I'll go to my grave like that. Oh, yes. Yes. How is it done in Mormon history? I think it has been the most fantastic thing that could have happened as far as church history is concerned. Outside of that, it was horrible. But in that, it has become the thing that today has been the impetus for having the transparency and the effort that is going on. Because the Salamander letter turned out to be not very far off. And then Michael Quinn produced a book about Mormonism and the magical worldview that he would have done without that. And what that does to situate and put in context Mormon's very earliest beginnings with the people that did it. And the kind of people they were, huge. And now our church is much less scared of surprises as they used to be. I mean, today, what goes on with the Joseph Smith's Papers Project? And more importantly, the stuff that's going on the website, the journals from the Cannon Boys, the massive way they are. It's a miracle. And you can read that stuff and find a lot of dirt.
I'm really grateful that you gave your time and effort to this. And I know it's sort of been taxing on your voice, so I appreciate that. Do you want to leave us with one more final thought before we go?
Yeah. When I come back, make it so me and my wife come back. And somebody else and their wife come too. So they can find out what the hell their families went through. The hell the wives went through. Because it was just as bad for them. So we're kind of lucky we get to get up and vent ourselves. They need a chance to vent themselves too.
Well, thank you so much again for your time and energy for doing that. And thank you, Brian, for being part of this. Again, if you like Brian's sultry voice, we do the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast. Brian is, I'm a big Mormon nerd. Everybody knows that, but Brian has got me nerded out like 10 times over. He's Celestial Kingdom nerd level. He knows everything about everything. So make sure you check out the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast. Again, if you've enjoyed and appreciated this watch party, go ahead and make a donation. Every little bit helps. And again, thank you to Grace Poole for managing this and for Shannon for coming on and for your wife helping out in the background. So thanks, everybody.